David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news. One of those stories is scientists shining lasers on light bulbs. Dave, why do that?
Well, it has to do with increasing the efficiency of light bulbs. And as time goes on, the light bulbs that maybe you and I have become very accustomed to growing up, what are called incandescent bulbs, these sort of round bulbs that give the nice yellow glow that a lot of people really like, are slowly going the way of the horse and buggy. And that's because these incandescent bulbs are not very energy efficient, and they're gradually being replaced by new types of fluorescent bulbs and halogen bulbs that are a lot more energy efficient.
So shining a laser on them somehow makes them more efficient?
Well, that's what these researchers wanted to find out. And the reason they even thought of lasers in the first place is because this team had been doing experiments with these ultra-fast laser pulses. And what they found is when they, you know, shot a few pulses at various pieces of metal, they could actually change the chemical properties of the metal without melting the metal. And where light bulbs come in is light bulbs have these filaments, these, you know, sort of coil-like structures that you see in the bulb, and these are made out of metal. And the researchers had noticed that when they fire these laser pulses at various types of metals, that with some metals, they could actually increase the amount of radiation that the metals absorbed. And obviously, when you're talking about light bulbs, you don't want to absorb energy, you actually want to emit energy. But they figured that maybe they could, if they could make a metal absorb a lot of energy, maybe they could make a metal also emit a lot of energy. And that's exactly what they found. They took an off-the-shelf light bulb, fired these ultra-fast laser pulses at it. It was a 60-watt bulb, and they were able to increase its brightness so that it resembled a 100-watt bulb just by shining these laser pulses at it. And what was really cool was that even though this light bulb was all of a sudden emitting a lot more light than it did before, it wasn't consuming any more energy than it did before. So they had made these light bulbs, which at baseline aren't very energy efficient, a lot more energy efficient.
Any commercial application possible here? I mean, ultra-fast lasers aren't something that you find at your local hardware store.
That's true. And these lasers are very expensive. But the researchers say this is actually could be commercialized very quickly. Even though these lasers are expensive, all it would take would be a few of these lasers set up in a factory. And once you've got the lasers in place, you're just, you know, shuttling a bunch of light bulbs in front of them. And they say this could actually be scaled up in the near term if people are actually interested in doing this.
Any other potential applications to this other than increasing the efficiency of light bulbs?
Well, really anything that deals with metals could be fundamentally changed by this technology. One of the experts on this article raised the possibility of using these lasers to increase the efficiency of, say, solar energy panels or even radar detectors.
Okay. So what's next?
Well, while we're on the topic of radar detectors, how about planes detecting birds? And this next story has to do with the U.S. Airways flight that went down in the Hudson River in mid-January of this year. And as you recall, Rob, this was considered a very heroic landing by the pilot because even though the airplane crash landed into the Hudson, the pilot brought it down in a very controlled way. Nobody was killed in the crash. So it was a very fortunate outcome for this airplane.
And investigators had ruled that it was a flock of birds that the plane ran into.
Right. Very soon afterwards. In fact, the pilot, I believe it even radioed in that he had hit a flock of birds. And indeed, when the investigators started looking at the plane after they had drug it out of the river, they saw feathers in the engine. So that seemed to confirm that it was a bird strike that had brought the plane down. But there were a lot of questions. What type of bird was it? Where had these birds come from? And figuring this out is actually really important. I didn't realize this, but bird strikes are actually a really big problem for airplanes. Since 1988, there's been 229 deaths, airplane deaths, associated with bird strikes. These birds have destroyed more than 200 aircraft, and they've caused over $1 billion in damage to airplanes. So this is actually a really big and a really relatively common problem.
Why so important then to find out where the birds came from rather than just look at ways to keep them away from airports?
Well, obviously that's important too, but you want to know where these birds are coming from because you have a lot of cases where you have birds nesting near airports. And if you can figure out what type of birds are posing the biggest threat to airplanes or where these birds are coming from, it could potentially help you manage these bird populations and keep them away from airplanes in the first place.
So what did scientists find out here?
What they did was they did this actually very detailed forensic analysis where scientists first collected these bird feathers that the investigators had taken out of the engine. engine. They did DNA analysis. They did isotopic analysis, a lot of different things they're looking at in these feathers. And the first thing they figured out was that the feathers belonged to Canadian geese, which were actually one of the prime suspects. So it confirmed that. And beyond that, they wanted to figure out where these birds came from. And to do that, they did what's called isotopic analysis, and they look for these versions of hydrogen. And these versions of hydrogen, which are called isotopes of hydrogen, vary throughout the country. So depending on what these geese are eating or even where they're nesting, they're ingesting and incorporating different levels of different hydrogen isotopes into their feathers, and the researchers can measure this. And what they found was that the birds actually come from a place in Canada called Labrador, and that they winter in New York, but that these particular birds were probably migrating out of New York just around the time of the plane crash, because New York had been experiencing a lot of snowstorms, and these birds were looking for a more pleasant place to spend their winter. So we know a lot more about the birds that brought down this plane than we did before.
So at that time of the year, wildlife managers wouldn't be expecting to see a whole flock of birds up in the air in New York City.
Right. And the idea is, you know, as we know more about these birds, we can do a better job of keeping them away from airplanes. And experts are also saying that the crash suggests that more research needs to be done into bird detecting radar to try to prevent a lot of these crashes in the first place.
So maybe those ultra-fast lasers will help?
Could be.
Okay, so last story. What's this one about? I see you brought a sound file with you.
I did. See if you can guess what this is, Rob.
It doesn't sound human.
It's not. It's actually a young orangutan laughing. And you'll notice right off the bat, it doesn't sound like a young human laughing, right?
Here it is again. No, it doesn't.
What you'll notice is that there is a lot of sort of more grunting there. There's a lot more inhaling, whereas human laughter tends to be a lot more vocalized. A lot of the ha-ha, you know, we sort of associate with laughter. So for this study, researchers wanted to do really a comprehensive study of as many primates as they could, study their laughter, and compare it to human laughter to learn more about how laughter may have evolved in the first place.
I had thought that scientists had theorized that humans were the only creatures that laughed.
Well, that was actually a prevailing theory. And actually, one theory said that only humans can laugh because something about us being bipedal, something about the structure of our bodies, the way we're oriented, allows us to laugh. But over the past few years, researchers have noticed sounds that sound like laughter coming from various primates. You know, primates, it turns out, really love to be tickled. Gorillas, bonobos, chimpanzees, if you rub a feather against their feet, they make these sounds that researchers have identified as laughter, even though it doesn't sound like human laughter. So it turns out humans aren't the only creatures that laugh. And the trick now is trying to figure out, well, how did this laughter evolve in the first place? And that's what this study is all about.
Something about the biology or the construction of our vocal cords or what?
Well, it's really more about analyzing the sound and seeing if we can see any similarities between humans and some of the other primates, and using that similarity to trace back maybe a common ancestor that may have laughed like we do or like our primate relatives do. And so for this study, researchers visited a lot of zoos and sanctuaries around the world and tickled young primates and recorded the vocalizations. And so they heard some things like, you know, the audio clip we played earlier. And what they noticed overall was that a lot of the primates sounded like the noises in that clip. There was a lot of grunting, a lot of inhaling. So laughter that didn't really sound a whole lot like the vocalized human laughter. But it wasn't always the case. In fact, with gorillas and bonobos, the researchers were surprised to hear more breathy laughs, so some exhaling when these creatures were laughing. And similar sounds have been documented in chimpanzees before. So there, even though overall there's not a lot of similarities, the researchers did see some similarities between humans and other primates in terms of laughter.
So how far back? I mean, is the idea to look at the common ancestor of both modern primates and us?
Well, exactly. I mean, the idea is to now find a common ancestor, knowing which creatures laugh most similarly to humans and tracing that back. And when the researchers did this, they hypothesized that laughter evolved about 10 to 16 million years ago in a common ancestor of humans and other primates. And they speculate the laughter probably sounded a bit like the laughter here.
Uh-huh.
a lot of grunting, more inhalation. So something that didn't really sound very similar to a human laugh, and that the human laugh really evolved over time. It appears to be an exaggeration of the laugh of other primates. So that may give clues to how it evolved in the first place.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into stories about how typhoons can trigger earthquakes and how stress really does turn your hair gray. And on the policy blog, Science Insider, we're continuing our almost daily coverage of swine flu and also a story about how President Obama is trying to support science in the Islamic world. He's made a lot of proposals recently about sending scientific diplomats over and other things, and we're investigating just how he plans to do that. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.